primary business of today is the introduction by the Auditor General of his annual report to this committee. And in that annual report, one of the important components would be the audit report that reflects
to engage with the committee. Then we'll come in after the audit committee, led by the chair thereof, Mr. Peter Moyo, has gone through their part of this agenda. Thank you so much, Chair.
Okay, then I assume it's up to the audit committee now to lead us.
Let me start off by introducing Chair, the committee members. Second from me is Sulman Patat, since he joined the audit committee earlier in the year. John Desmond Salmon has been with us literally from the beginning. And I'm Peter Moyo, I chair the audit committee. Chair, the nice thing about this is that we are really talking about what I consider to be a very, very clean audit report in an organization that's been run very well. And I think it's important for the committee to understand that the audit committee is made up of totally independent members. The audit committee is made up of four members. Unfortunately, Nomvula Mthombeni could not join us today. As I said, Solomon joined the committee earlier this year, and Professor Barak retired in January this year. The four of us are not in any way employed by the Auditor General nor any of the organs of state, so there is absolutely no reason when we actually look at the affairs of the Auditor General to have any other motivation, because all of us are independent. I'm now going to also just talk about some of the things that we did this year before I go on to the report. As you know, Chair, ultimately it is your responsibility to appoint the external auditors to the Auditor General's office, and we assisted this committee with the appointment of auditors. We had in the previous financial year appointed a firm of auditors that unfortunately merged with a firm that was no longer eligible to do the audit, not because of anything wrong. In terms of our rules, there is a view that if you've been auditing the office for more than 10 years, there might be questions raised about the independence. And Mo Stevens joined BDO, that had, who had been our auditors for the previous 10 years, so we had to select a new firm. And we nominated Quinana and Associates as external auditors, and the standing committee approved the appointment. So the financial statement or the annual report before you, Chair, is actually signed by Quinana and Associates. It's also important to note that during that process, we looked thoroughly at the issues around independence, because it's important that when the auditors express an opinion on these financial statements, there is absolutely no question around their independence. Other than not working for the office, it was also important for us to ensure that the people that we recommended as auditors to the office did not have a huge exposure of their income coming from the Auditor General's office. So as part of selecting the team, we will not allow a firm who got more than 10% of their fees from the office of the Auditor General, because independence is actually important, and Quinana and Associates met that criteria. And the big thing for them is to express an opinion on the financial statements of the Auditor General to ensure that, well, to say whether they fairly present the financial position of the office at the end of the financial year and the results of the operations and cash More importantly, we reviewed the adequacy of the corrective action that was recommended by the auditors. In here, Chair, I'll say even when I talk about any corrective action, the kind of reports that we got both from the internal and external audit say to us, and we interrogated them throughout the year, that anything that they brought to our attention were essentially issues that under normal, well, in audit speak, what we call housekeeping issues. And typically those things never even really get into the audit committee. But for the sake of transparency, they brought those issues. And it's also pleasing to know that the attitude in the office in terms of looking at those issues, no matter how small they are, management have a very positive view to taking corrective actions. It made our jobs much, much easier. We also reviewed the strategic risk profile, including the risks as they pertain to the strategic direction and the office of the Auditor General. And we asked both auditors to give us their written assessment of the effectiveness of the systems of internal control and risk management. And we also got assistance from Deloitte, who up to the end of the financial year were the our auditors, internal auditors in the year under review. Like I've already said, in our opinion, the controls within the office are adequate and they're effective. And as a result, we actually believe that those systems enable the office to produce financial statements that as a committee you can rely on. And we also of the view that in all material respects, the financial statements comply with the relevant provisions of the Public Audit Act and fairly present the financial position, state of affairs, and the financial results for the period then ended. Chair, it's a very short report. If our report is included in the annual report, I always say that although you prepare for a very long discussions, it's always much easier if a report is short because it actually talks about the quality and the caliber in the office. I must also add, Chair, that right from the beginning, the attitude that has been taken by the office of actually saying that it must actually be exemplary, because as the watchdog, cannot afford to be tainted. We've actually seen that permeating right across the organization. And as a committee, we are of the view that it actually does help strengthen the democracy of this country, because that's exactly what this office was set up to do. I don't know whether any of my colleagues, John or Suleiman, have got anything to add.
Nothing to add.
Thank you. Of course, the report is contained in page 78 of the annual report, so colleagues can look at that for themselves. And at this juncture, then I don't know if any member of the committee wishes to ask any questions of clarity or make any preliminary remarks in this regard.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Please.
Questions are first just to be directed to the Audit Committee at this stage, and then we'll deal later on with the Office of the Audit Committee.
Yes.
Okay. Now I have nothing at this stage.
All right. I assume that essentially your task really is confined to compliance, rather than really looking at issues of performance in various
Note of those three key issues which I think were fundamental in our calendar for this year. Specifically in terms of this annual report, Chair, the key objective of this document is firstly to report on the outcomes of our objectives as we were set out in our strategic plan and budget of 2010-2013, and secondly to also appraise the Parliament of the performance of our organization, the Auditor General of South Africa, in the year. As a reminder, as we always do in communicating our strategic plan on an annual basis, there's five areas that we have set out as our key areas of commitment. And what we are reporting on today is effectively around those five commitments, one of which is the whole goal around reporting in a manner that is simple, clear, and relevant in order to enable those that are charged with governance to exercise that governance and oversight without any ambiguity. Secondly, we've also committed ourselves to be visible out there and make sure that we clarify areas that were historically and previously difficult for some of the people in the system of finances and governance to understand. And we have put a lot of effort and premium on the area of leadership visibility as a way of ensuring that we contribute what we can to enhance the ability of financial and oversight structures in government to do what they can do better in order to come closer to the ideal audit outcomes that all of us have been talking about over time. We've also made a commitment that it is better for the audit office to produce its own people who can be relied upon, both in terms of their technical competence as well as their ability to do the work that we are charged to do in accordance with the Constitution and the Public Audit Act. We've also taken ownership of the fact that financial management in our own hands must be exemplary. We want to make sure that when we spend the resources entrusted upon us, we do it in a manner that is seen to be responsible. We do it in a way that is economic, effective, and efficient. And lastly, because we are auditors to the public administration, as it were, all tiers of government, we want to also be the standard setter in terms of the qualitative elements of our own environment. We want to make sure that as an office we have very strong internal controls and the stuff that we do becomes an example to the whole of government as well as other institutions that we are responsible for. So those are the five things that the rest of the activities that are spread across all nine provinces in the country revolve around, and we are very happy to say today that in almost all of these five areas of commitment we have made strides and improvements that I think are qualitatively better than the last time we reported to you. We have not fully achieved everything that we hope we can achieve around any of one of these goals, and we believe that it's a journey, but we affirm in our view that what we presented to the committee last year is significantly better than the previous time. If I go straight into the first goal on the simplicity, clarity, and relevance of message, we have spent quite a lot of time, as I said earlier on, this is a journey that we have been on to ensure that the people who are charged with financial management, particularly in government, have got the necessary insight into what is it that we are talking about in presenting the reports to them. The root causes we have identified, and many of these have been reported in our general reports. We have consistently put out in the public domain general reports which indicate what the root causes of the audit failures in some of the institutions that we are auditing are about. And certainly there is no stage where we can say that we have now completely achieved what we thought we intended to achieve on this goal, but we believe that up to now we are still on track to enhance our simplicity, clarity, and relevance of the message. One of the days when we would present a report to our auditees, which is written in technical language without anybody having an appreciation for a long time have been sitting in their audits. An example of this would be, for example, when we talk about the issues that are causing qualifications in their audits, if they have to do with assets, we spend time ourselves understanding what are the drivers, what are the things that drive these qualifications which are sitting in assets, rather than giving them a report cold which talks only about assets without giving them an insight into what the things that are driving those qualifications are. On the area of the information systems audit, we have also started doing a lot of work on this because we believe that all of the information, including the reports that we audit as an office, a large number of these are coming out of an information systems environment. We have enhanced our capacity to do audit work on the information systems environment, and we are planning. In fact, in the past year, we have made sure that the coverage has been increased both for the PFMA and the MFMA, so that we can also be able to generate some discussions and understanding on what are the key things that need to be resolved from an information systems environment. If one looks at some of the stuff that we've reported on in our general reports, if, for example, there's a shortcoming in the supply chain management area, if the information systems environment is weak, the chances are that that supply chain management is likely to also be compromised because people can have uncontrolled access to information systems. And that's why we believe this is an area that also needs to be focused on. The performance audit area around this area as well, on the simplicity of message, as members will remember, we have started baby steps around the area of performance auditing, and we have shifted our focus now to identify specific sectors that we are going to be focusing on. The work is underway currently. We've looked at the area of education as a specific sector, among others, where we do specific audits on the audit of infrastructure, as an example, the infrastructure that gets delivered in the education institutions as well as in health institutions. That report is still in progress. We will be presenting it towards the end of this year, hopefully. But most of those reports that we've looked at provincially and in almost all the provinces have indicated that there's a lot of value that can be generated if we deploy a lot of our resources towards the performance auditing. So our focus, as it were, under the simplicity area, Chair, has been to do continuously what we do in terms of auditing the regularity side of our audit, but at the same time we've also increased the level of work in the area of performance auditing. And I'm sure when we engage with the committee in the next couple of months on our strategic plan for the next year, you will see a lot of the area of focus around the area, among others, of performance auditing. There's a number of other assignments on the go, Chair, which I'm not going to go into the detail of, but I think one that is also of interest is the area of appraising the oversight and governance systems that are in place in managing state-owned entities. That is work in progress as well, but I think what I'm trying to illustrate is that it's not just the audit reports that we are focusing on here, but we are also starting to expand into other areas of interest which bring insight into the system of government on the economy, efficiency and effectiveness with which resources are being utilized. That's the first chapter, Chair, and I think in having looking at a high level in this first chapter, quite a lot of detail is contained in the annual report, and I'm sure that members, when they prepare for our engagement in the next week, will have enough time to engage with the details that we have put in that particular chapter, just to get a sense of what it is that we have achieved against what we committed. And the visibility of our leadership. This is the area that enables us to understand as well as to reinforce some of the pertinent messages that are contained in our reports, so that when those reports are posted and tabled in the different legislatures as well as in the national parliament, they do not gather dust. We make a specific effort as an office to say that as a leadership of the organization, we want to be visible. We want to be visible taking action on the issues that we are highlighting in our reports as per what is in goal one. In this regard, we have had a number of roadshows as planned right across the country in all three tiers of government, as well as in with other structures that are part of the oversight mechanism of either local government, national departments, and provincial departments. A lot of commitments have been made, which our people on a quarterly basis follow up on, and we follow up on these with a view to assessing whether the findings and the issues that were presented to those that are charged with the governance and administration of the different elements and areas of government, whether they are indeed making progress. So that come the time when we have to do the actual statutory audit at the end of the financial year, we're not seeing the staff for the first time, but we are part of understanding whether any action is being taken to address the issues that are highlighted in our reports. Around the visibility of leadership, again, I think one of the things that I think we need to highlight as an achievement here, Chair, is the recognition that we got as an office for the work that we do on the international front, where our peers within the establishment of international auditors gave the office a specific recognition for the sterling work that it does on the international front. And this work is largely our people attending and being part of a number of committees that are in the INTOSAI fold, which committees are responsible for developing international standards on auditing across the world. And we benefit a lot from that, because a lot of what is being developed in the world we also use here, and we are also able to check whether we are on track in the things that we do in relation to what happens elsewhere. Just a taste of the areas that we have interacted with in respect of the national stakeholders. There's certainly a huge focus and a lot of work that we have done as an office in the area of SCOPA. Traditionally, SCOPA is charged with processing the reports that we issue, but we've also seen the need to enhance our level of interaction with the portfolio committees. And I think that graph on the indicates the extent of involvement around the area of visibility that we have had with those areas of oversight that we believe are important in driving the implementation of audit findings, as well as other areas pertaining to performance information. So just a combination of the portfolio committees and SCOPA in terms of our regular stakeholder interaction is and the 94% one combines the two big graphs there. So we think that we are focusing our energies and our efforts on this area of visibility with the right people who are charged with making decisions and driving the implementation of particular instance of our audit recommendations. Similar profile in respect of our provinces. In provinces, we have split this out into executive authorities and legislative authorities. And the bulk of this is what we refer to as the key controls program. We've got a program where we have engaged with MECs, CFOs, and even in municipalities for that matter, mayors and municipal managers, where we, together with them, identify what are the key controls that they need to have in place in order for them to stand a better chance to effect improvement in the way that they manage their financial activities, as well as broadly issues of service delivery. And what we do in terms of this area of visibility of leadership is a regular assessment on a quarterly basis with them to assess whether they are making progress, as well as to identify areas where they are not making progress. And I'm sure all of us would have noticed also in the last month that among the many provinces that we have visited over the last couple of years, we are now in province number 8 that the AG has been going around, particularly within the area of municipalities, going door-to-door to the municipalities and engaging with the leadership of those municipalities for them to actually make the statement that this is their commitment, this is what they are trying to achieve. We are there to provide them the necessary assistance in areas where they need that assistance. And I'm sure at an appropriate time, the AG will be in a position to reflect with the committee on what our assessment of this project has been and whether it is going in the right direction. But certainly, I think if one looks at this commitment and the effort that has gone into it, it's physically been going to every single municipality, but there's only one province that is still outstanding, which will be done in the next year. So a lot of effort is going into the area of visibility, and we think that against our plans, we have probably done quite a lot, even to even exceed our minimum expectations. As far as our ability to add value to members of parliament, to members of the public accounts committees, we've also undertaken a number of training initiatives, which training initiatives, among others, revolve around clarifying what role we play against the role that the oversight structures play. And this is basically the type of visibility that we've also been driving, is to say that we are not just making ourselves available to institutions in isolation. We also recognize the role that the members of parliament play in the oversight continuum. And here, a lot of this training is largely around issues like what is an annual report, because the people that have to examine some of the issues that come out of our reports normally pick them up when they read the annual reports. And we've taken time to provide training to members of parliament and public accounts committees, among others, to give them an insight into how does the audit fit into the broader annual report, so that when they look at it, they can also understand that there is indeed a link between what we do and what the broad mandate of each of these departments is, as reported in their annual reports. And then the last bit, I think, in the visibility of leadership is also our own staff in each of the provinces, as we believe that if they understand better what they need to do to help in the improvement of audit outcomes, it's better to invest the time among others with them, so that they are the ones who are at the coalface engaging with the audit teams that they audit. That is, in a nutshell, Chair, so far as the area of visibility is concerned. Again, as well as on the first and in this chapter, we've got a lot of details that members can at their own leisure go through in the annual report. I spoke earlier about the area of human resources, indicated that is one of our key goals as an office, to say that if one goes back to about 3 years ago, we were in a situation where there were huge vacancies. I still remember the headlines that came in the papers after we presented our report. It was staggering numbers of vacancies. We are no longer in that situation. I think we have made strides as an office to increase our visibility, even to make our office attractive. In fact, we've turned this situation around, whereby we now have quite a lot of people who are very interested in coming on board as the Auditor General. Part of this is also evidenced by the occupancy levels that we have enjoyed in the last 2 years, which are hovering around 90%. This is quite a significant effort, because what it says to us is that as we march forward into the future, we have people that have worked in our environment, that have accumulated experience as auditors, and the chances are that if they are retained into the future, they are likely to be your experienced auditors who will be able to deal with some of the complex issues that arise in an accounting environment. And we think that we want to continue to provide them areas of learning and development, as well as to ensure that we retain our key executives right across the country, because the reliance on our own resources, we put a lot of premium on it, because it is those people who are trained in our methodology, those people who understand what the approach to auditing by the Auditor General of South Africa means in relation to our audits. And that's why we believe that even as we come into the committee now, we want to say that gone are the days when vacancies were the order of the day in our environment, where we were struggling with getting people to supervise some of our critical audits. We now have them in place. Our challenge is to make sure we do the right indication of the type of achievements that have been made, particularly in the area of our trainee accountants. We have got new people that qualified as chartered accountants, people who qualified as registered government auditors, as well as certified information system auditors. When I spoke in the first chapter, I spoke about information systems audit. These are the professionals who are accredited by a specific qualification as certified information systems auditors, which is a specialized area of auditing and appraising information systems. The employee profile, Chair, I think it's important to note that over the 5-year period, if one looks at the type of skills that we have in our environment, as at the end of 2011, we had about 375 chartered accountants. This is one of those professions that are very difficult for many people to achieve, but I think it's equally difficult for most organizations to retain people with this type of qualification. And if one looks at the outlook over the 5 years, I think we are in the right place. We have the right people spread across the country, and we can rely on their technical capacity to deliver what is expected, as well as new generally recognized accounting standards are being introduced. We believe that when they get implemented in the system of government, they will be audited by people who have an equal level of appreciation of the technical requirements that are associated with auditing those complex environments. So this is significant in the sense that without these people, without these types of qualified people, whether it is the RGAs, whether it is the information system auditors or the CAs, the chances are that if we don't have them on board, it may be difficult to assure the public of that we have applied our standards of quality with a level of rigor. So certainly, we look at this thing very closely, and we believe that the office has now become very attractive. From an office that, if one looks at it, in the last 10 years, you probably had these qualifications in almost double digits over the last 10 years. Now we are charging forward to creating a critical mass of qualified people. Many initiatives have also followed this, and unlike getting people employed in our environment and not attending to the need for them to expand their skills base, we invest a lot in providing them opportunities to continue to learn, as well as to continue to understand the area of public sector, because that's what they are auditing. And if they understand that better, it makes it easier for them to apply their audit methodology in it. And so far as the executives are concerned, we believe that when we need to replace people various positions as and when they become vacant, we will not look further away from our own shores in identifying those people that will be replacements for skills that will be lost, because we believe that people decide at different times to do something else, and certainly we think we do have, as you have seen in our profile of staff, sufficient levels of people to build a strong executive pipeline. Leading by example, just before I get to this, the area of human resources, when we come back to the committee and present to the committee our proposal for what we want to do next around this area of human resources, we've already made some strides towards this area, particularly in developing internal learning and development capacity in the office. So we just want to flag this, because we're going to be sharing with the committee in detail what that is about, because we believe that in the whole area of skills development, we also have a role to play. While we engage people as trainee auditors, while we engage people as auditors in the various areas that we are responsible for, we also have a responsibility to make sure that from a skills point of view, people walk out of our environment better equipped to handle the many challenges that they might face as they continue to audit or as they go out to serve in the public sector. But that issue of the learning and development new development that we are working on, and we are going to be engaging the committee on our thoughts in that regard. Leading by example, this is one area which we look out to improve on an ongoing basis, particularly as it pertains to compliance with the statutory deadlines for submission of financial statements as well as for the release of the audit reports on those financial statements. I think we have done well in the past year. Our record indicates that we are still in the 90% levels of compliance in respect of the finalization of PFMA and MFMA audit cycles. This is important in the sense that it enables the likes of the oversight committees to do oversight on work that is current, as compared to oversight work being done on information that is 5 years old. At least currently, the information that is being presented to the committees that process our reports is as current as in the 90s. So the record of our achievement of those statutory deadlines is quite impressive. On the side of the broad-based BEE as an office, we've also made sure that we do not take the wrong decisions in respect of this in terms of supporting suppliers that are transformed organizations, and we have an accredited level of 3 in relation to the broad-based target. The audit committee has already spoken about the audit report that was finalized by the external auditors. There's no need for any bleach to be applied to this. It is as clean as members have seen. So we would like to also confirm that we are committed to this goal as an exemplary office. The last thing we want is to come here and have an audit that needs a little bit of bleaching, and then we struggle to stand up and say the things that we are meant to say to everybody else when our own environment does not look as exemplary. So this is really our commitment, and we do not think that there's any room for us to compromise on this. In the past year, the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors did its first phase of what they refer to as a firm level review. We have had an opportunity of the independent regulator coming to look at our policies, particularly the existence of policies and procedures that enable an audit office to produce the kind of work that we produce. They've given us a nod in all respects in terms of the existence of those policies. They're still going to have to go through a phase where they test the consistent application of those policies. That's the next phase that's coming. But it's pleasing to note that at least at their level, they have not identified any significant gaps. Because if there were any significant gaps, then it would mean that there are questions in respect of the environment in which these audit reports that we issue are being produced. So we take comfort from the fact that the policies and procedures which are set out in terms of the international standard on quality assurance are in place, and that the office will now have to be tested to make sure that it does apply them consistently across the board. I did earlier on...
This would be IRBAI. Do they issue a formal report? Would it be contained in the annual report? Or how does it work?
They issue a management report to us. I mean, this is the first time this was done, and basically the report they are issuing is a report that they give to us to say, we've seen that you have a policy on ethics, and that policy on ethics could be enhanced if you focused on an additional step, for example, to make sure that it is a stronger policy. So they will issue a report to us. It's not a mandatory report. And of course, we are voluntarily subjected ourselves to this as well. So it's kind of a management report which says to us, focus on these areas of improvement in order to make sure that you do not encounter problems in the future. So we do have a report of that nature, Chair, which is called. that part of what was adopted as part of the Johannesburg Accords, pursuant to the hosting of this international congress, was the adoption of the international standards on supreme audit institutions, which are auditing standards that for the first time the global community of international auditors have adopted, and these are going to become the guide, as it were, for the whole community of international auditors in the future. And we are part of that game, and in fact, among other things, as an audit office, we were charged with chairing the working group on the value and benefits of supreme audit institutions, and there's a lot of work that is currently happening in that regard as we are preparing for the next Congress of NCOSAI, which is happening in Beijing in 2013. So certainly I think we will benefit from this, because when most of the work that is being done is implemented, we will be among the people that were part of its creation, and when we implement it, we believe that it will be much easier, because we would not need to do additional research to understand the background to some of these. Employment equity profile. Nothing significant to highlight, except to say that we continue to pay particular attention to this. And I think the profile, as members can see, based on designated and non-designated groups, is indicative of the strength of the audit office across the country as far as the employment equity profile is concerned. We set ourselves a target around the area of quality assurance and the quality standards that we ought to achieve. We have an internal committee that is made up of some independent members whose job is to evaluate issues of quality and score the quality that our senior managers right across the country are able to demonstrate as they do their audits. We still are in the 70s insofar as the levels of quality are concerned, and this is based on a sample selection of a number of audit files, whether they are municipality audits, whether they are national PFMA audits, and we think that we have enough to be comfortable with the fact that there's sufficient levels of adherence to the quality standards that are required of audits. There are certain gaps that we identified in this past year, and we've already started addressing them to make sure that we continue to remain within and above the industry averages that we are comparing ourselves to. And I must say that there were no instances when there were gaps that were identified. There were no instances that were identified which indicate that we have expressed inappropriate opinions. All of the opinions that we expressed were supported by the independent quality assurance, except that they highlighted certain areas that we can still improve on. This is the slide I was talking about regarding the timelines and the trend of the PFMA and the MFMA. As you would notice, the trend is consistently in the 90s. The only exception, as we had explained when we presented the 2009 proposal, was confined within one particular province. But this was more a timing issue, because within a week of the cutoff date, where that 87% under PFMA is showing for 2009, within a week, that backlog, which was outstanding, was submitted immediately. So that was just a glitch, because we wanted to make sure that whatever we issue in terms of the reports is going to pass the test. And so I think if one looks now again at 2010, we've gone back to the numbers that we have previously been reporting in terms of the timely delivery of the audit reports. And these are the dates that indicate our strength on the ground, because if the annual financial statements is required in terms of the MFMA and the PFMA, if the PFMA prescribes that the departments must submit financial statements by the 31st of May, the requirement upon us is to release our report within 60 days from receipt of those financial statements. So between the 1st of June and the end of July, those 2 months, that's what these slides are trying to indicate, particularly the PFMA one, to say that by the 31st of July, we were in a position to report on about 96% of information that was submitted. activities, that's quite a number of them were concluded within the prescribed delivery timelines. On the area of supporting the private audit firms, as we have said, the model that we have set as an office is a combination of what we do ourselves with our own people, together with what we request the private audit firms to do on our behalf. And we have a pot of money that we set aside every year to dish out work to all the firms in the profession. And the work that we dish out is done rigorously via a tender committee process where allocations are given based on predetermined rules and predetermined standards to ensure that we provide the necessary support to both big, medium, and small firms. And these are numbers that indicate the level of support that we continue to give to the profession. I think what needs to be said is that based on the total revenue that we generate, at least this year, which is about 1.8 billion, as I will deal with now in the chapter on the financial sustainability, just about half a billion of that is specific work that the rest of the accounting and auditing profession does on our behalf. We're still committed to this because we believe that the model of our delivery will never support a situation where all of this work is done internally in the office, because then it means that we will continue to have a commitment to pay for costs at times when there will be no work that we are doing in respect of the audits, because as we, as members will appreciate, there are only two financial years in government. The one is the 31 March and the other one is June. So if we had all the people on board to do this work for ourselves, we won't be able to manage the peaks and troughs that come with that two financial years, because the concentration of our peak period is around two cycles. So we think that this is an area that will remain with us for some time until circumstances change. Lastly, on the funding side, three years ago we presented what we referred to as a revised funding model to the previous SCOWEC. And when this SCOWEC came on board, at least in the first financial year, it was never associated with losses. So I think that's one of the positive attributes of this committee, that it does not know losses insofar as the HGSA is concerned. It only knows surpluses. So I think we must please make sure that that is maintained, because that is exactly what's going to enable us to do the things that we're committing to do in the future. When we implemented that funding model, please, Chair, you can say to Parliament, you are not a committee of losses, at least you have got surpluses as part of your record. Our net surplus for this year, Chair, was 133 million against the budget of 68. A large portion of this, I think, is largely partly stuff that ourselves we can fix, because it's largely things that we committed to spend, but because we have been doing quite a lot of initiatives, some of them by the time we get to the end, we haven't really got around to even planning for some of them. So this kind of comes into our surplus as a saving, but we have identified that as an office to say that if we put things in the budget and we know we do not have the capacity to do all of them at the same time, we must try and adjust our budgeting accordingly. And I think we are going to reflect that when we come with our budget for the next year. But certainly, as far as the margins are concerned, if you recall with the funding model, we said after we've done an analysis over the years of what is it that will make this office financially sustainable, we came to a conclusion that a minimum, according to the model that we have, which is a mix of our own hours as well as the money that we spend with the rest of the profession, we said a minimum of 30% margin will enable us to continue to do the activities that we do as an office. And when we did that analysis, we've also noted that for the past 2 years, we have been operating at the margin of about 30%. So effectively, the difference between the billing and the cost cost of producing an audit. That difference of 30% is what enables us to pay for the electricity, to pay for the laptops, to pay for getting here, as well as other activities. So those surpluses that are there, Chair, if one looks at them, a large portion of it has also got to do with us having to structurally to fix some of our planning activities to make sure that we budget for things that are capable of being done in a 12-month cycle. Cash-wise, we are pleased that at least we are in a cash-generating position, in that additional cash was generated from our activities. Much as we still have the challenge in respect of collecting our debtors, but quite a number of the different areas of government do come to the party when it comes to paying for their audit fees. And I'll show a slide here which indicates that as far as provincial governments are concerned, as far as national departments are concerned, we do not have a history of a backlog of payments. The only area, as we spoke about earlier, is in the area of local government. Municipalities, by far, some of them, concentrated largely in areas like Northwest, Eastern Cape, and Northern Cape, are still battling with paying for some of their audits. That is one critical issue, I think, which we also picked up with the committee the last time we engaged with the committee. But for the rest, at least we know that for the things that we need to do as an office, there is at least reasonable levels of cash available to fund our activities as we go on. Just the highlight of what is contained in the annual report, a summarized version of how the surplus was generated. That's the 30% I was talking about earlier regarding our gross margin on our own hours and generating the surplus of 133. So if one looks at the surpluses over the period, in 2008 we were writing in red ink, and in 2009 we also were writing in red ink. Turn that situation around now. So if you look at 2010 is the first year that we implemented what was agreed in terms of the key principles of the funding model. Among those principles in this funding model was to uplift the limit that we put on the rate at which our tariffs were growing based on the salary increases of our senior employees. So once we had done that, it enabled us to charge the right amount of fees to our auditors. So these surpluses that we have now, if one looks at them, there's 2 years of surpluses. The first year was the 2010 year of 99, and now it's 133. We are in a process, because one of the things that are required in terms of the Public Audit Act, the committee is required to deal with the issue of the surplus at every financial year end. And one of the things that we are working on as an office is to prepare a presentation that we are going to bring to the committee to say, here are our initial thoughts in respect of what we believe this surplus could be used for. And that specifically, if members were to make reference specifically to what their role in respect of this is, it's in terms of Section 38(4) of the Public Audit Act. We need to, at every financial year end, engage with the committee on what to do with this surplus. So we will bring that presentation. We're still sorting out a number of elements to it, just to put a proposal to the committee as to what needs to happen. So that is coming, and we are hoping that we can engage in detail with the committee. We haven't had an engagement like this forever, I think, in the past, because, as I said earlier on, a number of years leading up to 2009 were those that were in red. So I'm sure that it would have been very tricky for us to have an engagement with the committee on a negative surplus, because it's not really... there wasn't going to be much discussion when the stuff wasn't negative, but I think we are now in positive surplus territory, and I think there's a need for us to have that discussion. We will advise the committee on the specific date when we would want to have that discussion, so that we can make sure that we're still in line with Section 38(4). The breakdown in terms of our revenue, Chair, is, as I said earlier on, the bulk of what we do in the office is generated from our own hours. We've got elements of contract work, which is that 543. That's the amount of money spent to get the rest of the auditing profession to deliver on our behalf. And on On the international front, as I said earlier on, this is our penultimate year of involvement with the international auditors in the United Nations. We are in the process of starting to position ourselves. In fact, we are already in progress to position ourselves for replacing what we will lose when our assignment at the United Nations comes to a conclusion in 2012. Hopefully, we will be lucky to pick up other audits of agencies associated with or related to the main United Nations. What we have here is our audit effort of the United Nations as an institution, but there's many other agencies, as you know, the likes of UNHCR, the likes of ILO, and many other institutions that we would be interested to focus on in order to ensure that we do not lose the capability that we've developed, firstly to attract people, because when people know that part of what they do is also venturing into other international institutions, the institution of the AGSA becomes attractive as an employer of choice. So we don't want to lose this. And of course, we are also cognizant of the fact that our primary responsibility as an office sits in the local environment as the primary auditors of government. So we've also managed this to make sure that we do not overcommit our resources to international auditors. We do not want to become the international auditor, but at least if we've got access to a few audits there, our people will continue to be excited by the fact that at least for 2 or 3 weeks of the year they can go and sit in New York and do an audit in those big buildings there. Talking about the debt and the trend of the debt that we have, as you would see in that graph, it's a graph that is moving. I guess the one to focus on is the one in local government, the one in the middle. The amounts of debt that are starting to settle around the area of local government is indeed an area of concern for us. We have engaged with the committee on this, and we would like to, and in fact the committee the last time we met invited us to come up with some detailed additional analysis on some of the underlying features of this debt, which is an assignment that we will pick up once we have gone through the process of the annual report and give the committee a detailed view of what efforts we have put in place up to now, what level of success we have achieved in the area of collecting debt, especially in the area of local government. As I said, the other ones are not that tricky to follow. This is the graph that indicates the spread of that debt. If one looks at that 137 million, just wanted to hone in on the local government debt in terms of this particular one. If one looks at that particular 167, those four that are bigger than the others are largely your Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Northwest, and Free State. So if one is thinking about our debt is largely sitting in those provinces, both in terms of quantum and aging. So the money is growing, but it's even over substantially longer periods of time, purely within and around those four provinces. So I think the strategies that the committee would want to engage with us on will potentially revolve around those areas, because if we put in the bulk of the effort in those four in terms of the ability to collect that debt, we might be able to win the day in terms of the debt position. And this is just a split in terms of the total outstanding debt. There's no doubt that quite a large portion of it, if one looks at the total of 390 against the 225 at 31 March, a large portion of this was sitting in the national government, provincial government. And if you look at the aging of the national and provincial, I mean, the amounts are not big. These are exceptions. These are exceptions of a few institutions that battle from time to time to pay on time. The reality is they do pay. I think the big area which requires attention, as I said, is the local government area. And in conclusion, Chair, the AGSA, as we have said earlier, continued to do the stuff that it committed to achieve. both locally and internationally. And we think that there's no reason why we must depart from that commitment. Financially speaking, with the exception that there are issues we need to talk about in respect of the surplus that we've generated, we're not a profit-making entity, but at the same time, we also know that opportunities to reinvest in improving our cycles, improving our activities, and improving our people will largely need to be funded from the surpluses that we generate. We never had that opportunity before because we were, as I said, you know, spending and utilizing resources that were in excess of what we were able to generate. Now this is the time for us to start looking at what is it that we did not manage to do, either on the human side, on the infrastructure side, that we could now be capable of doing because we've now got at least an amount of surplus. Clean administration and the efforts that we continue to engage with our stakeholders continues to be our primary area of engagement. Our auditors know right across the provinces and right across the country that theirs never stops when they finalize an audit report. After the audit report has been finalized, after the root cause analysis has been done, they also know that they need to be out there to continue to explain and to engage with those that are charged with governance. As well as the transformation that we continue to drive as an office is not something that comes to an end. We continue to try and find as diverse a base of skills as we can, as well as people from different backgrounds are part of what is in our office, and we continue to support those emerging entities via the audit work that we do and the work that we dish out to the profession. And when we do that with a sense of responsibility because we know that the profession as a whole has helped this office to achieve what it has achieved over the years, and we're still committed to ensure that we deal with them as professionally as we would deal with our own auditors. And lastly, I think we, as has been highlighted in our Johannesburg Accord in Nkosi, you know, that our professional activities are well placed as an audit office to continue to contribute to strengthening oversight in the area of public administration, as well as for us to continue to activate our activities as an office in a manner that is beyond reproach. And with those few comments, Chair, it's our pleasure to invite the members of the committee to interrogate what is sitting in this annual report based on those highlights. Thank you.
Thank you. It was quite a marathon. I propose that we pause for a few minutes, have a body stretch. Apparently, there's plenty of that and some other refreshments. And as we do that, reflect on what was presented before us, just to indicate that the process is going to be that today, essentially, we're receiving the briefing and interacting with it somewhat as an introductory interaction with the report. In the interim, the research unit would then package the issues for our deliberation as a committee next week, Friday. I don't know how we're going to do it because I understand that there is being scheduled the People's Parliament to where?
Mangaung.
But I'm not sure if pause there, and we will have this body stretch and resume. The ideal is that we should be able to finish well ahead of 12 o'clock, because I understand other people have difficult flights to catch on a Friday. All right, so let's have maximum of what, 10 minutes. Thank you.
No.
DA.
It's DA.
Okay. I think that's what I'm
with you. My family, my sister-in-law lives in the UK.
Yeah.
I studied at UCT.
Yeah.
Graduated there. And the news I've got friends that a lot of the ex-students at the high school are either there in the US or the UK.
So you...
And I used to, when PhD started out, I was one of the first members of the Island of Oba.
Yeah. What did you know, what are you doing now?
I'm enjoying these things.
very much, Mr. Chair. I already feel welcome. I'm Anshin Raya. I'm new again on this committee. I have served on SCOPA a few years ago, and in that capacity I was a member of the panel that did the interviewing to appoint the then new Auditor General, who's now the incumbent there, and I'm now back at SCOPA and also on SCOAC with this committee. Thank you very much for that. Yes, I enjoyed the presentation, and I must say I also enjoyed reading through the annual report on preparation for today's meeting, because coming from other committees, and I won't mention specific names, it can be very depressing when you see all the everything that can go wrong, and sometimes anything that can go wrong does go wrong. And coming to the audit committee, dealing with the Auditor General, it was really very refreshing and actually quite a pleasure to read through the annual report of the Auditor General, seeing an entity that's actually working and that's meeting its targets and indeed leading by example. So that's a great pleasure. But having said that, I have just a few questions for clarity mostly. The one is on the debt, bad debt, local government. I understand it's an issue that this committee has dealt with before, but I would like to ask, there were graphs, pie charts actually, giving us a breakdown of local governments per province. Is it possible to have a further breakdown of the bad debt per actual local authority? I know there are many, but I'm sure you have that information. That would be great to have that. And then also per province, to have the individual provinces breakdown of the bad debt per province. For the province itself, not just the local governments within the province. That's my first question. The second question deals with governance issues. Performance bonuses are awarded, and that's great. People do their job well, they should be rewarded. But I'd just like to know, I hope that it can just be confirmed, that performance agreements, the Auditor General has entered into performance agreements with the staff that should sign performance agreements, and that all the relevant staff has indeed also declared and submitted their financial interests at the due date. Has that happened? And then my third question, I noticed somewhere in the report, not sure which page, but that offices are leased and not acquired, and that's obviously an expense. Just a question, isn't it better to actually buy or acquire the offices, and why have you decided not to do that? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's from my side.
Thank you. We'll just take a round. I had the week. Yeah, let me take the week next.
Thank you, Chairperson. Pardon me for asking questions that might have been dealt by the committee at some stage, because I'm quite ignorant for this. Chairperson, my first question would be on it's on page 61 of the annual report. In terms of the timeline, when it comes to other PFMA organizations, the target that you achieved was 80%. Can you give us reasons why you didn't perform as other PFMA organizations that you have achieved 96-97%? Secondly, Chairperson, it's on page 2 of the annual report on the investigation. Your target was 95% and you only achieved 50%. I just want to establish what are the reasons for this low achievement. The other questions, Chairperson, it's on page 71 of your annual report, where you talk about that about your financial results, and one of the factors that influence your financial results is that you charge a below market related audit fee structure, but without compromising quality. I just want to find out what's the rationale for charging a below market related audit fee, and whether at one stage the audit costs are not going to exceed the audit income. Chairperson, the other question, sorry, I'm jumping around. through to municipalities. In page 75 of your report, you do allude to the fact that this problem resides mainly in low capacity municipalities. Like I've indicated, I'm new to this committee. I just want to establish whether you had any interaction or discussion with National Treasury to be able to resolve this issue, because I assume it's going to be a persistent problem, given that these are low capacity municipalities. And in terms of your page 75, the last issue I just want to be it's on the the synergy between your regularity, on its page 35, the synergy between the regularity audit teams and the investigation units. Can you just explain to this new member how the two work together to ensure that there's the success in combating fraud and in minimizing fraud and dealing with any fraud-related cases?
Did I see you, Prof?
Yes.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair. I don't have a question today, but I want to pass a general comment to say that we as a committee applaud the achievements of APSA, and we'll always join hands in counting the blessings of their reputation, promise, as highlighted earlier, by their visibility and leading by example. I wish all organizations would adopt this policy. There is no doubt that Chair, the work of APSA, in my view, is indeed respected by all committees in Parliament, and I'm referring to those that I said in the Court of Squad, and also the international community. Now, just want to give them my feelings in the Japanese language. I would say to them, they made an equal point, an excellent point, and therefore they must keep distinction and keep this excellent point. Thank you, sir.
I think Dr. Chacha is ahead as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your presentation. I echo the sentiments of my colleagues that this is a very functional unit, and I'm sure it will remain that way. When we went on our oversight visit and we visited various offices, it was very clear about the credit control difficulty that you're still climbing over. And I'm just wondering now, on page 116 under the notes where we did the provision for the impairment of receivables, which is $45 million, whether that is related to the bad debts. And if so, that seems to be quite a big number, and is it something to be concerned about? And then on the next page, 117, there were advances from the National Treasury for assistance to the debtors, but I think that you asked for more, but you didn't get as much as you wanted because the Treasury simply doesn't have the money to give anymore. So I'm just concerned that there is financial pressure on your ability to do your job, which is now showing up in the financials. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right. That's the full package. I'm hoping that as soon as we get responses to this round, we will just pause and just deal with housekeeping issues now that
most recently we have had an internal roadshow in the organization where we have confirmed that from a performance management point of view that system is in place, and all the business units have confirmed that they do it. The targets that we set are specifically targets that have to do with the stuff that we commit to. So if we've got these five goals, we try and embed these goals to make sure that what we say in respect of goal one becomes relevant for a senior manager, becomes relevant for a business executive, becomes relevant for all sorts of lower level staff. So certainly there are performance agreements for all. As far as the declaration of financial interests are concerned, it's a requirement in order for us to apply and to adhere to our international standards on quality control standards, the one I spoke about, which was part of what the IRBA evaluation was about. Part of it was to understand whether we do have those policies in place. Internally, we have also set up about a year and a half ago an internal ethics unit whose responsibility, among others, is to push for the advocacy part of ensuring that our staff do appreciate and adhere to our ethics policies that we've adopted. We've adopted an ethics policy which is based on the international financial, based on IFAC, which is an international federation of accountants. We've also adopted the local ethics policy, which is driven by the Institute of Chartered Accountants. Now, every team member involved in an audit, there's a specific requirement for them to complete a financial interest declaration, as well as any declaration that may point to an existence of a possible conflict of interest. Should we be concerned about a particular declaration, there's a proper follow-up process which gets driven by the ethics unit to make sure that any issues that come up get dealt with and get sorted out, so that we can minimize the risk of people being involved in audits where there may be an incompatible relationship between the auditor and the auditor. So those are part of what this environment, when I said earlier on that this environment from which we produce these accounts, we appraise it on an ongoing basis. And these are annual declarations that people must make. Office leases, why have we not decided to buy? Yes, it's true, we do lease all of these buildings and the environments and the offices that we use. Partly, I think it also has to do with the fact that, as I said earlier on, for all of these past years, we've been in a situation where we were making losses and all of that. And so even if we were interested in buying a particular building, just the resources wouldn't allow it. But I think the more fundamental part of it also is the fact that we still want to retain the flexibility to adjust our resource requirements should the need arise. If I can give an example, for example, if I remember when there was one of the budget votes that was presented about beginning of this year, around the time of the expanded public committees, I think it was in one of the president's votes where they were talking about the need to assess the need to have the current structure in the government as it is, in terms of the three layers, you know, local government, provinces, and all that. And we were saying to ourselves, if we were caught up in a situation where there was a decision that we must have lesser than what we have now in terms of the different sites that we are responsible for, and we were locked in a fixed commitment in terms of the building that we bought, and we needed to respond, for example, to the changes that are taking place outside of our control, what would the implications be if we were owning properties all over the place? And perhaps because of the new decision, we were then no longer required to, let's say, be in 9 different provinces, but maybe because of whatever the decision would be, we would be needing to be in lesser than 9. So we're also looking at it from that point of view to say, when we want to put our people in Limpopo, let's do a buy versus rent evaluation based on the information that we have, as well as what may transpire, which is not in our control. So effectively, the view that we took was that we're not in the business of property, because we don't want to sit with the challenge of having to sell this building in the future if we needed to move. Or if we grow and we now need to move to another spot, which is the case in our Pretoria. For example, in Pretoria, in the head office, particularly around this time of the PFMA, when all our staff has to come back to the office, because most of them don't spend time in the office. They spend part of their time in the OTs. They normally are back in the office in concentrated period of time. We now have a problem there with parking because many of them have got cars, so we can't park in that building. So we're saying to ourselves, this is a flexible situation to be in because we can go and find another building across the road to accommodate the excess needs that we have. So I think it's really driven by issue, by the considerations of flexibility and as well as to be able to adapt to changing needs. That's why we adopted the approach of renting rather than owning them. And other PFMA, there's a couple of other audits that we do, quite a number of them, and I know that there's a lot of them, for example, here in the Western Cape. If one looks at the 80% that's been achieved, the question was why that percentage and not the 90s that we used to. And the reason for it is there are a number of these small entities, things like hospital boards, huge concentration of them, particularly here in the Western Cape, where you've got about 150, for example, small entities. Many of them, for many years, have never submitted financial statements. These are entities that are set up in terms of the PFMA, but just the effort to try and get financial statements versus the cost of doing so, we sometimes just walk away from them. Because even in terms of the amounts involved and the values that are associated with them, they are quite small. Some of these have not been audited for many years, and some of them are so small that even to try and get them audited is an issue. So that's the major reason among these other PFMA ones. And if you look at the Note 7, which is part of that page, it does say in the footnote which types of entities are these that we have not been able to get to. But I think the beauty about all this is that the bulk of these big PFMA entities that have been allocated appropriations from the national budget have largely been audited. It's only the smaller other entities, and the secular, I think it's secular one entities and those type of entities that we struggle to get them eligible for. Low capacity municipalities and engagements with National Treasury. We are constantly engaging with National Treasury on this matter. In fact, National Treasury has an arrangement that we have with them where the category of debtors which are referred to as 1% debtors, those debtors whose total revenue, if you look at our audit fee, I must get this right now, if you look at our audit fee, if it is going to be in excess of 1% of the total revenue that that particular municipality generates, National Treasury comes to the party. They do pay, but in most instances they are not in a position to pay for everything. They recognize the fact that these low capacity municipalities have got to be audited to a particular standard. There is no smaller version of auditing principles that applies to them because they are small. They also have to adhere to the requirements that National Treasury sets. So National Treasury recognizes that their asset base and their ability to generate income is so tiny that they themselves, as National Treasury, come in and make up for the shortfall in terms of the audit. So there are definitely engagements, but even with that one, we also know that they're not able to pay for everything, so we kind of end up absorbing the difference. And if I take an example and I look at a province like Northern Cape, our office is based in Kimberley, and if those guys have got to go and audit a municipality in Springbok or far-flung areas of the Northern Cape, not only is it the audit cost that comes with it, but it's also the cost of going there, cost of keeping people there 800 kilometers away from the office because they've got to stay there for the week while they do the audit. So sometimes when they arrive there, they discover that the CFO, when they said that the trial balance is ready for auditing, most of the time that is not the case. So they've got to. So some of these are the inefficient environments that we find ourselves auditing in, and we recognize they are small and they've got not a revenue base to generate sometimes. Synergy between regularity and investigations, relationship thereof. What we said was that the area of investigations, classically speaking, as in getting out to do investigations, is largely being taken by people who are charged with that responsibility on an ongoing basis. The likes of SIU, the likes of investigations that are done by Public Protector, all those institutions. We do have working relationships with them in terms of our MOU arrangement that we have with each of those institutions. What is happening in terms of the relationship between the investigations unit and our regularity audits, there's an international standard on auditing fraud and error in the audit of financial statements. What we've done is we said, in order for us to strengthen the ability to identify and address the risks associated with fraud and error in the audit of financial statements, let us rather use our core teams of people within the investigations together with the regularity audit in the planning stage. If, for example, we are going to tackle supply chain in a particular department where we know that supply chain issues and issues of irregular expenditure are prominent, when we do the planning of the audit, we don't do it in isolation from consideration of fraud and error. We get those people from investigations who have adequate level of expertise to say, if you see payments, for example, being made around the 24th of December in a significant way, from a fraud awareness point of view, you've got to be flagging these risks up front when you plan the audit, so that you can ask yourself the question, who is this supplier that is being paid such big amounts of money on the 24th of December when everybody else is supposed to be on holiday? As an example. So that's where it comes in. That's where that synergy comes in. We want to have people who have got the proper training, proper insight, and proper ability to identify red flags that could assist our regulatory auditors to develop audit procedures that will help us address that issue. So that's where the relationship comes in. So we've diverted our attention and said, maybe the area of a full-blown investigation capacity does not necessarily belong with us. True sense of the word. There are other agencies out there that deal with it. But ours is to make sure that those that we have internally who have got investigative skills can be used to strengthen our hands in the pursuit and implementation of regularity audit. The issue of the 45 million provision is basically the provision that we have to make because we recognize the fact that a lot of our debtors are potentially impaired. So it is a provision that is raised in order to make sure that the asset that we put in the books in respect of the recoverable amount of our outstanding receivables is not overstated to the extent that we have uncovered those that we know could potentially not pay. And in some of the presentations, we've identified the total amount of what we refer to as illiquid debtors. Those are the ones that consistently say to us, we do not have the money to pay you. We're not going to say to you, come tomorrow, because tomorrow you will come and you won't have it. So we know that there is a category of these debtors, particularly concentrated within the municipalities. I think there's about 36 million of them that say, sorry, we can't pay you any other day. So we do make this provision, which is required in terms of the accounting standards, to impair the debtors if you have a reasonable basis for thinking that we are not going to recover that debt. We haven't written them off. They are still in our debtors' book, but we have made an accounting provision to make sure that instead of reporting 100,000, we put through a provision of 45 so that our net amount of debtors becomes 55. Instead of the full amount, which may be overstated.
Okay, if I may just add some of the comments just to complement the messages that the DAG has shared with us. If I may start with the issue of the integration, I may just want to take it beyond maybe the Special Investigations Unit to say all our specialized audit capabilities, we have adopted an approach, as was indicated earlier in the presentation, of getting them to be integrated with the annual audits, which is the regular audit. Both the systems audits, which the DAG has placed specific emphasis on, as well as performance audits. Because this is where the skills to diagnose the real risk reside. And this applies similarly. And as an example, our decision to place specific annual emphasis on auditing procurement and supply chain. This is where this team is used extensively to look into what we call the horizontal audit of supply chain, so that when we come up with findings in that area, it's findings that we know have been given thorough thought by people that have got an understanding of the regulations, practices, and everything to do with the combating the risks and highlighting the red flags around supply chain. So it's a specific, practical, implementable example that we have adopted around the area of supply chain. But generally, it goes across all the other specialized things, I mean, areas like performance audit and information systems audits. The other area I think that was raised was the rationale for our fee structure to be below that of the market rates. This is informed by the fact that we are not a profit-making institution, and therefore our fees are only determined to cover all our overheads and all our operating costs, unlike the private firms where their margin for their businesses are much larger than ours. Our margin, net margin, is 4%, which is a minuscule margin to make sure that we can have a surplus that we can set aside for the rainy day. In the private sector, those margins go into double digits. So that's the reason for that. And because of that, in the tariffs that are given to the profession, there's a tariff for the private sector, there's a tariff for the Auditor General, all of which are published in the circular by the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. In fact, those tariffs, we do engage with the Institute, South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, on an annual basis. Because even the firms that do work on our behalf, they don't use the market, the private sector tariffs, they use the Auditor General tariffs when they do work in government. I think those are the issues I just needed to expand upon. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I'm going to suggest that at this juncture we pause on this one and see if we cannot quickly deal with other housekeeping issues, and if time still allows, we can still go back to one or two issues that members might still want to clarify. Firstly, just to indicate that there are outstanding processes or projects
objection. So the minutes are adopted. I don't know if there are any matters arising that anybody would want to highlight at this stage, arising out of the minutes. Otherwise, I think most of the issues would have effectively been dealt with, or work in progress. Is that insofar as that aspect is concerned, we will only be having the researchers' notes to work with next week, because the committee will be sitting on its own. So if anybody feels that there are issues that they still want to raise at this stage with the Office of the Auditor General, otherwise you are at liberty to finish any written questions in between, so that we can obtain those responses and be able to deal with them before we finalize our own report. Yes, Ms. Dre.
Mr. Chief, yes, just a quick follow-up on the answers. I'm happy to with the answers, but I want to make a suggestion on the. My question is regarding governance issues, that was the performance agreements and the declaration of financial interest. Happy to hear the answers, but I want to suggest that you add it into your report in the future, because leading by example is another way we lead it by example. We found that that's a big problem across the public sector, in most other public, in most departments, national and provincial government, huge problems. The senior management sector simply don't comply with these requirements. They don't submit on time, or the financial interest, if at all. And also the same goes with performance agreements. It's more often just ignored than actually adhered to. So I would suggest you add that into your report. Then in terms of the bad debt, local government, provincial government, you can provide a further breakdown. We'd appreciate that, but I certainly won't be able to be at the next meeting next Friday. If you can make it available electronically, also then going green and saving some paper, that would be highly appreciated. Is that possible? Thank you.
Just before we proceed, I've noticed that we have only made you adopt one set of minutes, and that is the set for the 9th of June and the 2nd of June. Maybe we can take them together and put them for them up for adoption. Is there anyone who wants to move? Dr. George, you move. Anybody who wants to second the adoption of those? Yes, Ms. Mamalu. Any objections? All right, so we're done with all our outstanding sets of minutes. All right, any further comments or questions? This is the last batch before we adjourn. Yes, DAG.
Chair, just a question in respect of next week. We just want to make sure on our side that we adequately prepared, just to get guidance from the committee as to whether we are going to be finished with a list of questions and issues that we need to expand on coming next week. So that we don't get here and we find out that we're going to see we will provide it next week. So we would prefer if it's possible once the researcher has gone through all the details to at least provide us in advance so that whatever it is that you may require further, we can bring it along at the meeting next week. Either way, find it as soon as we have to be here, prefer an advance notice.
Yeah. In the interest of time, shouldn't we request the research team to have questions circulated by Wednesday, the latest, to both members and simultaneously to the AG's office, so that when we engage next week, we are able to deal with everything completely?
Any further questions for clarity? Yes, Whip?
Negative reflection on our final report as a committee report. surveys have been carried out in the last, I think about 3-4 years ago, or thereabouts. And out of that survey, out of those surveys, we have in fact structured our intervention and our approach to dealing with the government in a manner that responds to the issues that came out of the survey. And that survey has, to a large extent, informed the emphasis that we're putting on the first two priorities of the organization, which is the simplicity and clarity and relevance of our reports, as well as the issue of visibility, which has also given us an opportunity to also reflect on the issue of human resources, how we professionalize the people that go out and do these audits, and the cost of audit itself. So everything that we do, as covered in our priorities, has been informed by the immense feedback that came out of the survey. And having recognized that, felt that it will be inappropriate for us to continue to do these surveys annually. Let's suspend the surveys, let's respond to the issues where we feel that we've responded to them sufficiently. We will then take stock again and get a sense of how the stakeholders feel about how our response to their feedback, because it was very valuable. As the DG has mentioned, we are on course to responding to most of these issues, but we have not reached the optimal level of satisfaction, even by our own standards. We still have a lot to do to deal with this and respond to these issues. Yeah. One of the practical issues that we have identified as a result of this survey is an analysis that we'll share with you when we bring the strategic plan and the budget in the next few weeks. The analysis of the efficiency, the level of inefficiency that we pick up in the whole of government, and how much of those inefficiencies influence the amount of audit fees that will be contained in our budget, and what is it that we intend doing with that excess audit fee that should not be there the day those efficiencies are responded to by government, and what work we're doing to conscientize government to deal with these inefficiencies. Some of the, in fact, most of the emphasis that we are placing on the door-to-door municipalities is about weeding out these inefficiencies. And the character, in fact, of our door-to-door in the Northern Cape in August last year was dealing, by and large, with the issue of a small municipality being charged a audit fee close to 1 million rand. But if you take account the fact that you spend 4 or 5 times the time you should spend in that audit, this is what is driving inefficiency. Because they don't have internal auditors, they don't have CFOs that do their proper work. You get there as an auditor, you wait for some time to get the work, even what is presented to you requires an extensive amount of modification before you can give them a decent audit. So that's the analysis we'll be doing for score work as a part of analyzing our blue book and as part of, in fact, the issues that the DAG referred to as justifying the need to retain some of the surplus. Because there's a lot of investment that we're making to government, which we're not charging for at the moment, to try and deal with and eliminate some of these inefficiencies. So that's basically has been the benefit of the survey for us and how we've responded to it, hence the approach that we have adopted in being so active and visible to deal with these issues.